are Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Kevin Feenstra, and he'll be answering your questions on matching warm water bait fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share a podcast. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. We'd really appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is being copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Kevin Feenstra about matching warm water bait fish. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. Again, that's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Kevin, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Kevin's latest book, Matching Warm Water Baitfish, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills. Take lots of notes, and maybe you'll be the proud owner of Kevin's latest book, Matching Warm Water Baitfish. Our guest tonight is Kevin Feenstra. In his early 20s, Kevin began guiding in West Michigan as an alternative to graduate school. Now, more than 25 years later, he has never looked back. Kevin's passion is swinging flies for steelhead and lake run brown trout, but he loves to fly fish for any predator that swims. He resides in Newaygo, Michigan, guiding many days each year on the Muskegon River system and wherever he can fish, fishing wherever he can. To that extent, he regards the Muskegon as his second home. The Muskegon is a large and diverse fishery, so he guides for migratory fish, resident trout, and warm water species. His steelhead, smallmouth, and trout flies have been published in books, magazines, and online. Kevin's first book, entitled Matching Baitfish, Patterns and Techniques for Great Lake Steelhead and Lake Run Browns, was released in 2020. His second title, Matching Baitfish for Warm Water Gamefish, was released in late February of 2025. In addition, he's been featured in fly fishing books and has contributed to international, national, and regional fly fishing magazines. Furthermore, he has had cover photos published on issues of various magazines, including Midwest Fly Fishing Magazine, Eastern Fly Fishing, Michigan Trout, and Ontario Out of Doors. Kevin has authored DVDs for steelhead and smallmouth bass, including Striking Steel, Searching for Steelhead, and Big Appetite and Smallmouth. Kevin, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Roger.
Excuse me, I'm trying to get my throat clear here. Give me a second.
No problem.
Okay. Yeah, and, you know, I'm realizing now that I seem to have a couple of different titles of your latest book. Now, I've got Matching Warm Water Bait Fish. Is that correct?
That's it, yeah.
That's it. Okay. And folks, the subtitle of his book is Patterns and Techniques for Smallmouth and Largemouth Bass, Muskie, and Other Predators. So that book you just recently published, Kevin, and what inspired you to write it, and how did the whole book come about?
Well, I wrote that first book, which was covered a lot of cold water bait fish, and it was a really interesting book to write. But the thing about doing underwater photography of cold water bait fish is that it's really cold. So
Yeah.
the beauty of the warm water bait fish was that I could go out in the peak of summer and the low water where it's clear and take a lot of photos of things I couldn't do at other times of the year. And in a lot of different parts of the bodies of the water that are in this area. So it was just a neat project, and I've always been interested in nature, and so this was just a kind of a natural extension of that.
And complementary to the cold water book. Yeah.
Right.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of camera are you using for your underwater shots that you do?
Well, a lot of what I use is a Sony A9, which is a really fast autofocusing camera, and I have a housing for it.
Oh.
I had been using Olympus cameras underwater, but I, on a whim, placed a bid on a really what should have been an expensive housing on eBay for that A9, and by some miracle I won. It was a housing that somebody should have paid several thousand dollars for, but I got it for 400, so
Oh.
maybe it was meant to be. So I used that camera for most of the photos in this book.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. The reason I ask is when I went to school for photography. So I have a
Oh,
degree in
wow.
illustrative photography, and one of the 7-week courses I took was undersea photography. And
Really?
the
Cool.
school I went to was in Santa Barbara, California, and so we did all this a
Yeah.
lot of diving out at the Channel Islands out there and so forth. But
Okay.
so I'm always curious about the underwater stuff that people do. Fascinates me.
Right.
But
Yep.
anyway, yeah. So let's dive right in here. We've got a lot of questions, and we'll try to cover as most of them as we can. We'll talk about flies. We'll talk about targeting smallmouth and largemouth bass, and then muskie and pike, and just general, bait fish techniques, strategies, and so forth. So let's start with, what makes bait fish patterns so effective for targeting predatory fish like smallmouth, largemouth, bass, and muskie and others?
That's a great question. Obviously bait fish are a food source, but they're also kind of a middle to upper part of the food chain food source. So not only are they appealing because they can be abundant, but they can also kind of fill a dietary need that they don't need to refill very often because they have, a lot of protein in them and a lot of calories for a fish. So bait fish, almost every healthy river system, in fact, all of them have bait fish of some type in them, and they vary depending on the water quality and temperature and, of course, the geographic location and things like that. But it's pretty well known in the fishing business. If you throw a big bait fish pattern, you might catch a big fish. And so they're a really interesting and fun way to apply this.
Yeah, it always interested me how ravenous these fish are, like pike and muskie and stuff, because I remember catching, we were up on a lake, Kisissing Lake in
Okay.
Canada, and caught pike and, with a tail of another fish sticking out of their mouth, and they're still trying to eat another one, right? And it's like,
Right.
really? You haven't even swallowed the first one. But I
Right.
thought that was funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you choose the right bait fish pattern for the different species and, water conditions? Or are you using many times the same kind of pattern for,
Well,
bass versus pike, or?
that's a great question too. So growing up, like most people fly fishing, I just kind of learned what generally was in a river, or I guessed at what was in a river, and that was a really good way to just judging from the information that was out there. Now, of course, we have the internet, and you can pretty much find out what bait fish live in each river system just by a quick internet search. But a lot of it comes from just experience on the river. You know, I often tell people if they're coming to a river and they don't know what bait fish to tie on, just to look at the bottom of the river and look at the color of the river, the riverbed, and a lot of times you can find a bait fish pattern that can imitate the fish that are using the bottom of the river as camouflage.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, size of flies a minute ago. And is there truth to that? In other words, the larger the fly, the larger the fish when it comes to...
Sometimes there is, certainly. I mean, if I have some really good friends that are musky guides, and they'll tell you the bigger the better, you know, as long as the person can cast it. But in the same token, you know, there's advantages to smaller flies. They're easier to get sink. They're easier to cast. If, you know, you always have to weigh whether you can present the fly well with whether you want to use the big fly at that. So, yeah, and certainly there's a lot of smaller bait fish, too. If you go to a lake or a river, for example, a lot of them have really healthy populations of shiners, which are 1 to 3 inches long. And if a fish can make a meal out of many smaller fish just as easily as it could by getting one big one, then they would certainly gorge on the smaller fish as well.
Right. I think about it not in warm water, but in salt when I fish for tarpon. A lot of times we've had patterns that were only like 3 inches long, and yet you'd catch a 70, 80 pound tarpon on that. And they're known for their bucket mouths, right?
Yeah.
You go, yeah, well, I guess any opportunistic, right? I mean,
right.
If it's there and it's edible, I'm going to eat it, I guess, because I don't know when the next one's going to come around. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about smallmouth and largemouth bass.
Sure.
Is there a difference or key differences on how smallmouth and largemouth bass hunt bait fish?
There is big differences. I mean, there is some overlap too, but smallmouth and largemouth to some degree are ambush predators. They both use the of their habitat to blend in and to eat prey. Largemouth bass, because of their huge vacuous, their massive mouth, they tend to really like big prey and they feed a lot on minnows. But one of the big difference between largemouth and smallmouth is that smallmouth, they tend to be more of an open water fish. They tend to skirt the weed beds, for example, whereas a largemouth bass will almost always be in the cover or really close to the cover. One of my favorite things as a kid was to throw a rubber frog on top of lily pads, and that's where you'd get the big largemouth, and you'd certainly never find a smallmouth there. There's other differences too. You know, smallmouth, if you just look at them, they have crushing jaws, so if you ever put your finger in their mouth, you can kind of feel that. But they, smallmouth will tend, you know, their primary food in a lot of places is actually crayfish, and that ability to crush the crayfish is really vital to them. But they also opportunistically eat all kinds of minnows and just about anything else. I've caught them with mice hanging out of their mouths, and I've caught them with a variety of other things. And I have friends that have caught them with snakes coming out of their mouths. So they'll eat anything, too. It's just their tendency tends to be to use that ability of their mouth to crush things and eat them.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense. What are your go-to bait fish patterns for smallmouth? And, you know, do they differ from the largemouth patterns that you use?
I would say that's very true, yeah. In general, you know, with largemouth, most of the patterns I'd carry would be pretty good-sized, substantial patterns. But with smallmouth, you can use pretty, you know, I'd say moderate-sized flies, not typically small flies, but moderate-sized flies, 1 to 3 inches, and my best patterns are pretty simple with smallmouth. A lot of times it's craft fur material. Gray olive craft fur is probably one of the best bait fish materials for freshwater you could ever use, in my opinion. But also, you know, adding some flash to that type of material is what really, really makes it effective.
What's that material again?
Gray olive craft fur. It's like I'd call it like almost a damsel green craft fur. It's but it's got some gray in it. It's a hairline product, really good. But you can also get gray olive marabou. Yep. Marabou and other colors, very similar, but kind of a dusky olive is probably my favorite color and material. So,
do you tie that with a underbelly as well, with contrast, or just
sometimes? Yeah, that's another. Usually, rather than underbelly material, I'll give it a kind of an opal-colored flash underneath the material, just to give it a kind of a sparse belly look that reflects light a little bit.
Okay.
Probably one of the best fly tying materials I use for the belly and for the tail of baitfish patterns is, it's not even a fly shop material. It's the tinsel that people put in Easter baskets, kind of the opal colored tinsel. And I use it on a lot of smallmouth and largemouth flies. I use it on pike flies, and I also use it a lot in the winter for our trout and steelhead. So it's just something I rely on a lot for an underbelly
wow.
type material.
Yeah. What about water temperature? Does that affect how bass feed, and what should we do as anglers to adjust our fly selection or our presentation for them?
Yeah, I definitely think it does, especially the bass species in particular. This time of the year, if you're going to catch a smallmouth when the water's cold, it's generally in very slow water, and you're presenting a lot of times a meal that's big enough to kind of wake them up from their winter slumber. As the water gets warmer, at first they'll move into kind of pre-spawn areas and they'll feed really heavily. And during the spawn, you know, of course we leave them alone. But then as the water temperature gets warmer in the summer, the fish distribute, and the warmer water typically brings more weed growth with it. And so the smallmouth in particular will be along the edge of the weeds in the heat of summer and patrolling for any bait fish that come out. So the water temperature definitely affects it. As you head into the fall, you find that a lot of times the smallmouth will move into timber, and especially if you're fishing moving water like on a river, a lot of times you'll find the smallmouth in kind of stale water with timber, and they feed really heavily in the fall. It's a lot of times really good smallmouth fishing when I'm just starting to guide for the migratory fish, and I kind of a lot of times wish I could keep going with the smallmouth for another week or two, but anyways.
Yeah. So the smallmouth are spring spawners. What about largemouth? Are they also spring spawners?
They both are spring
okay.
spawners, yep. Yep. In Michigan here, there's some waterways that are open to catch and release year-round, but traditionally the best season for most people would start in late June. Yep. In May, late, yep.
Late June? Okay.
Late June, yeah. The month of June is typically when a lot of people start looking for warm water fish like pike and bass and things like that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. What about any particular effective retrieves you use for baitfish patterns for bass?
Yeah, with just about all of these warm water predators, you know, one thing that you do to kind of help with your retrieve is you tie flies that sink very slowly. A lot of times you give them some flash over the back so that they sink really slowly, almost like a parachute. And when you have that kind of neutrally buoyant fly, you can cast it out and you can give it a couple strips and then give it a long pause. Just let it hang and flutter. And, you know, it's not like a trout where you necessarily need to be keeping and moving the fly very quickly. You want to give that bass who's using his camouflage against or on the boat.
Let me do a commercial here. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com. Or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Kevin Feenstra about matching warm water baitfish. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, you were talking about retrieves and yeah, about the fluttering down of the fly, and I thought that was really, really a good contrast to, like you say, to trout fishing. where you want to keep it moving a bit more. And so there's the bass like that wounded look, I take it then.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Let's, since we just did take a break, you know, I want to ask you what's going on in your fly fishing world. I know getting a book done is a huge endeavor, but tell us about what's happening in your fly fishing world.
Well, it was kind of a frenzy when the book came out. Winter is always a time where I'm doing a lot of public speaking anyways, and the book kind of added to that. So I kind of had a little tour going, and then now I'm, because of the time of the year, I'm guiding 6 days a week right now, probably until, the third week of June or so. So I've got a long haul going ahead. Yeah, but other than that, other than just the book, that's been the excitement of my life. I live in a pretty small town and pretty quiet. I've got three little kids and life is good.
Good, good. Now, what are you guiding for right now? What species?
So this time of year, we're kind of moving into our spring steelhead run here. We have steelhead fishing and we have a lot of resident trout that we're catching kind of incidentally. And our season just closed here, but we're picking up some really huge walleye kind of as bycatch right now, too. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a question about that came in rather late. But can we talk about that in our next section, muskie and pike?
Sure.
They kind of fit in that category there. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
What makes muskie such a challenging species to catch on the fly?
Well, that they are really the fish of 10,000 casts. I went fishing the very first time I really did a muskie trip was to the Upper Peninsula, and I was fishing a friend with on a river that we'd never fished before, and this was probably, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, and we fished for 5 minutes, and a muskie followed it out, and within an hour, we'd caught a fish, and, you know, we caught actually several that week and thought there was nothing to this muskie fishing. And then the next 2 years, I went back and didn't catch a single fish. So,
wow.
But the thing about muskie is that unless you're fishing really extraordinary muskie water, most lakes don't have any more than one muskie per acre. So,
wow.
In fact, when in Michigan, when they plant muskies, they figure they'll plant one muskie per acre. So not only are they just a big, cunning fish, but they're also, you know, they're not very abundant anywhere you fish, unless you're someplace awesome like Lake St. Clair or some of the other places that maybe are a little more dense. But usually, if you're going to fish for muskies, you're going to have to look for them because they're usually spread apart, and a lot of times you got to cover a lot of water to make it happen.
They're by the 10,000 casts, right? It's
right. Yep.
So to reduce the 10,000 is find the fish first, right?
And then,
which is probably easier said than done, right?
Right.
When you go out for muskie, are you looking for some kind of sign, or are you sight fishing to them, or what? How do you, you know, since then,
yeah,
what have you learned?
All the muskie fishing that I've done has not been sight fishing. Muskie to me are a great fish that I've put a fair amount of time into. The river system that I actually guide on here is pretty lightly populated with muskies. So they're more of a incidental fish a lot of times. But Michigan in general has a lot of good muskie fishing scattered around, and our DNR has taken the time to make the muskie fishing better. But muskie fall into a category of a native fish that was kind of pushed out of the area, so the state is trying really hard to reintroduce muskie. There's programs to reintroduce Arctic grayling here and trying to expand the lake trout population and everything. It benefits the angler because now we're having more and more muskie here. But if you're looking for muskie, you know, look for good spots to ambush prey and do your research as to the good muskie fishing in your area. They're pretty widespread, even outside of their native range now, because a lot of places have stocked them in to provide an extra fishery or maybe to control another species of fish because they're really good at eating big fish. So, yeah.
Are they part of the one fish per acre thing? Is that because they're highly territorial as well, or is it
Yeah,
more
highly
around the food source?
territorial.
Okay.
I think because they need big food sources, I think that's part of it as well. I mean, I know there's places where you will get more than one an acre. Sometimes, you know, in big fisheries, they might congregate where there's big food. But, you know, muskies kind of take a bad rap, but they, in some places, you know, living here in Michigan, we have places where people actually hate the muskies because they think they're eating the walleye or the other sport fish. But in reality, a lot of times when our DNR stocks muskies, the first thing they look for is the population of suckers, especially white suckers, because that's the muskie's favorite food. And if you're tying a bait fish pattern for muskies, it's not a half bad idea to have a good sucker imitation in your box.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yeah, and well, suckers are on the bottom normally, right? They're bottom feeders.
Right, yeah.
So they must be hunting them.
Right.
Or I don't know how, I'm trying to visualize in my mind how the muskie's finding those suckers or how they attack them. Yeah. One thing that I remember so vividly is the figure eight technique. And
Right.
I've done that with a casting rod, but not with a fly rod. Is that still considered an effective technique with a fly rod?
Yeah, you know, the guys that guide muskies a lot of them will tell you that if you do a figure eight after every cast, your chances will be so much better at catching a fish. Over the course of the day, even if you don't see a muskie behind your fly or lure, you know, it's a little bit more challenging with a fly rod than spinning gear, I think, because the spinning rod, you can put your lure right at the end of the rod tip, whereas with a fly rod, you typically have to have your leader outside the, you know, you have to keep the fly line inside the guides of the rods. So you
Right.
need a little more distance. You probably have to sweep the fly a little bit further. For a while there was a trend where they were adding a little bit longer fighting butts to musky rods so you could have a leverage to do that figure eight a little bit better. But definitely is a really cool way to catch a muskie is on that figure eight.
Yeah, when I first encountered that, it was through my uncle, who was a practical joker, you know, in so many respects, right? And we were out with my then young son. He was maybe, I don't know, 11 or something like that. And my uncle was telling us, well, first of all, he put a T-ball bat in the boat. And my son says, well, what's that for? And he says, well, if we get a big muskie, I got to hit it over the head with this T-ball bat because
Yep.
they're vicious. I don't
Right.
want them in the boat alive with me. And then
Right.
so that kind of scared my son. And then sure enough, we're out on the boat. And he says, okay, now every time you reel in, you do this figure eight. And we're like, come on, uncle, come on. Are you just joking
Yep.
with me? He says, I'm not joking with you. He says, just do it. And sure enough, we did get one follow-up that day, and it crashed the bait. We didn't catch it, but it crashed
Okay.
it right next to the boat and scared all of us
Yeah.
back to death. But then we were believers, true believers.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so, I remember that so vividly. And so does my son, will never forget that. But, it was a kind of a very exciting day. Yeah. So how do you rig up for your leader and tippet for muskie and pike?
Right. So definitely with the muskie, you need something more heavy duty. And the castable, bent, flexible wire that you can get now that you can actually tie knots in, I think Scientific Angler sells a good material, but so do the other fly line distributors. But, you know, you can actually knot it to a swivel and then knot it to your fly, which is really useful for tying on kind of an awkward material. And so definitely do that. When you're rigging for muskie and pike, especially with muskie, you know, you're not usually using a very long leader because if you do have to do that figure eight, you don't want to have to, you want the fly to be pretty close to the rod tip.
They're not too leader shy, huh?
Not at all, no. Muskie are probably, they're probably as fearless as they come. You know, most fish will kind of avoid underneath your boat, but a lot of times if you get one to follow, they'll just be sitting under your boat until you you know, run the fly in that figure eight. That's when people get them. So,
Yeah, that's what this one did, went under the boat that we were fishing, and then he came out from under the boat and, crashed the fly. And we had talked about size before with the bass, but, you know, do muskies react differently to large flies versus small bait fish flies?
You know, you can get away with small flies, but to me it seems like anything smaller than 6 to 8 inches, you drop off in the amount of fish that you move, especially the bigger ones. If you think about it, they're eating suckers or some other large form of bait. So it makes good sense that a 8 to 12 inch fly is kind of where you want to be to imitate that kind of food source.
8 to 12 inches.
I've seen people, right?
A lot to
I've seen, yeah. Right, it is, yeah. I used to go up to the Upper Peninsula and fish with a couple of buddies, and then they actually started guiding up there, so I'd have to go up myself. Boy, trying to cast musky flies all day and control a boat and then try to land a fish by yourself is pretty tiring, but it's really worth it with those big fish.
Yeah.
I did have a friend I was fishing with a guide friend of mine and another friend, and he told us that muskies love pink, and this friend of ours, and he pulled out this little steelhead fly. To this day, I'll never forget it. It was like 4 inches long, maybe 3 inches long. And my friend and I both looked at each other and kind of rolled our eyes and couldn't believe it. Darned if that guy didn't catch two muskies that day. And one was, you know, very large. And I just, to this day, I think it's so sure. As a rule of thumb, bigger flies work great, but you can certainly catch them on smaller flies as well.
Jason Stacy in Kentucky asked, what is your go-to pattern for muskie?
If it were me, I would use Matt Grzewski's baitfish pattern, which is actually in that book that I just published, which is a great pattern. He goes by the name of Adaptive Fly, and you can look him up, but he's got some really good patterns. So that's one great pattern, just as a default, the general yellow and tan sucker pattern that has, you know, yellow feathers flanking it and some brown antron over top of it is a good default in the waters that I've fished to as well. Those would be some of my favorite types of flies.
And switching over to pike, well, let's see. Oh, there is another muskie question specifically. Steve Schramm in California. He says, what is your favorite throwback fly to convert muskie that follow but don't eat? By throwback, I'm thinking he's got a different fly that he's trying to attract them with? Is that the idea?
Right, yeah, that's a pretty good question. I think from almost any of the big predators, you know, a lot of times I'll go from something really flashy and dazzling to a more subtle fly. So, for example, I'd be throwing a big articulated fly that has some flash and a muskie or a big pike followed it. Then I'd probably follow it up with something really natural, like a kind of a mid-sized sucker imitation or a golden shiner imitation or something like that. But that's true with all different types of fish too. I mean, I do that with pike. I do it with even with our migratory steelhead here too. You know, I'll fish a pretty big flashy fly, and then if I miss the fish, I'll go back up to the top of the run and fish, you know, a smaller, more natural pattern, and that a lot of times will do the job.
Ruben Amador in Monument, Colorado asked, do you have smaller size patterns you'd recommend for throwing from a 6 or 7 weight rod? He says, I bank fish for pike in Colorado and typically use a 9-foot 7 weight.
You know, that's a good question. Pike, you don't necessarily need as big of a fly. A lot of times what I tell people is it's more about color with pike. If you, for me, just a mid-sized fly that has a yellow body and a yellow tail, and then I cover it with some copper and silver flash, and then I put a pink head on it. And yellow and pink and 4 inches long will a lot of times outfish a bigger fly for northern pike. That's just another really good color combination is, you know, the old reliable white and red too. So you don't necessarily have to be real big, and remember, you can give a fly more presence too, just by, you can add more flash to it, which doesn't, flash typically doesn't add a lot of weight, and you can give a smaller fly a bit more presence by adding flash. And, you know, for me, gold, silver, copper, and that opal color, those are kind of my four big flash colors. And you can add them to a smaller fly to make it seem bigger in the water. And a lot of times that's what it takes.
Let's take a quick break here, and then when we'll come back, we'll talk more about techniques and presentation for these predatory warm water fish. So hang tight, I'll be right back. Discover the power of pure skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft hackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kevin Feenstra about matching warm water bait fish. If you'd like to ask Kevin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Kevin, Phil in Kentucky wrote in and says, here on the internet, he says, have you had a musky attack of fish that you had already hooked and were fighting?
No, I have not, although I've been in a boat where I've seen it happen. I've had that happen many times with northern pike where we were fighting smallmouth and the pike would come and take it right off the line. And it didn't even have to be a very big pike. I mean, I had 2 or 3 pound smallmouth on before that got eaten by, you know, a 25 inch pike. So it's pretty amazing. I've had other predator fish that have done that. I've had a client hook what he thought was a really big smallmouth and had a big channel cat come and clamp onto the side. And ruined the opportunity. So, you know, fishing for all these predator fish, and you definitely will see things get eaten at some point.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah, it's an interesting question because I know it happens a lot in the salt, you know, especially with sharks attacking. Yeah, you get a nice tarpon on or a bonefish, and a shark will come and grab it. But I didn't know how prevalent it was in warm water predatory space. But it sounds like it is. Yeah, yeah. Anything to make it a little bit easier, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So here's a question on techniques and presentation. So how do you decide whether to use floating, intermediate, or sinking line for the bait fish patterns you're using?
So kind of to preface that, it kind of depends on, you know, your scenario. If you're fishing from a boat and you can bring multiple lines, then you know, you might bring all three, but if you can only have to choose one, you know, a floating line can do almost everything. You can always add a sink tip to it if you need to. Intermediates are nice. They keep the fly level. There's actually a lot of the popping bugs you use for bass, especially the diving type, will work really well on an intermediate line. And, of course, the intermediate line is great for stripping streamers. I mean, it's just a really good line that keeps your fly and level for a good distance. The sink tip is more of a specialty line, although if you're fishing for pike and muskie, a lot of times you'll use a teeny type line. You know, they come by a lot of different names these days, but lines with an integrated heavy sink tip. But a lot of times I'll use a sink tip for smallmouth when I'm having a tough day and I'll be fishing goby patterns, for example, or crayfish patterns or helgramites very slowly along the bottom. You know, if you're having, bass can be among the most moody fish. You know, you think that they're pretty easy to catch, and one day you might catch 60 of them, and the next day you can't get a single one to bite. And usually that's when I would crack out a sink tip and fish very slowly and I'd cast a fly upstream. If I was in a boat, a lot of times what I'd do is I'd park the boat in, along a run, and I would cast the fly upstream, and then as the line got tight and I felt it graze the bottom, I'd just start twitching it and jigging it around. And a lot of times when the fishing's really tough, you know, that's a good kind of sneaky way to get a fish to bite. The other way to do it, if you're so inclined, is if you decide to go the floating line route and you can't get the fly down, you can always do what's called the Holschlag hop, which is a really interesting way to present a fly. Basically, you put a little
I don't want to interrupt you, but you cut out when you named that.
Sure.
That. Could you start over on that, please?
Sure, yes. It's pouring rain again here, so it doesn't surprise me. So one of the techniques that you can use is, it's kind of a neat technique called the Holschlag hop. It was named by a pretty well-known smallmouth guide in Minnesota, and it's a really an interesting thing. You put a little tiny indicator at the end of your floating fly line, and you tie on a small minnow pattern with some weight or a crayfish pattern, and you cast it upstream and throw about half a mend into it, and as it comes across, you jig that fly, and if the end of the fly line does anything unusual, then you have a fish. When the fishing's, it's not my favorite technique, but when the fishing's tough, it's a really deadly way to guarantee that you're going to catch a fish. And as a fishing guide, it's always
kinda
nice
like,
to have those.
Kind of like dead drifting a minnow pattern with tweaking involved.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, yeah, it's exactly right. You're basically, it's like an activated strike indicator. It's not like if you're, you know, if you're trout fishing where you don't want to move the indicator at all, but with a smallmouth, you're actually popping that indicator up every now and then to give the fly a little jigging action. And a lot of times that's how you catch kind of some of the oddball fish, like, you know, sometimes we catch things like dogfish with it and channel cats and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of other fish, I did get a last-minute question sent in here on the Internet. David in Texas, and he's asking, what's your favorite patterns for pickerel and any tips on how to fish them? And as I understand it, pickerel are also known as walleye, right, just depending on where you are in the world? Or is that?
I don't know. He's probably, you know, there's members of the pike family that are called pickerel. Usually people fish for chain pickerel, which live out east. And I would say the same type of thing that I mentioned earlier, the yellow and pink fly or the yellow and red.
Okay.
But they're very aggressive fish that doesn't grow as big as pike. If you're talking about walleye, then I would go a little different direction. I would go with a fly that imitates a shiner or a shad, something like that. Ideally, you know, my best success with walleye is with that craft fur fly that I told you about with some gray olive craft fur and some flash in it. And usually with some lead eyes because walleye are a bottom-oriented fish.
Yeah, I've always understood that. Again, when I was a kid fishing with my uncles and my dad and grandfather, you know, they'd love to go walleye fishing, and they were always fishing like minnows on the bottom kind of thing.
Right.
So, I mean, that becomes more difficult with a fly and a fly rod. How deep do you need to get for, you know, for walleye? And again, when we were up in that Lake Kississing up in Canada, I caught a walleye fishing for pike, and it was not in deep water. So
right.
I'm kind of wondering about, where they hold.
Hold in pretty moderate water sometimes. It's more about the time of the day, you know, if you're fishing at night or early morning or late afternoon or dusk, you might find them in shallower water, usually the same areas where you might find a bass skirting the weeds during the day. You might find that walleye in the afternoon. It was always pretty interesting when I was snorkeling and I'd see walleye basically laying on the bottom along the edges of the weeds during the day, and there'd be hundreds of bait fish above them, but you know that as soon as the sun comes out, that walleye becomes the most terrifying predator of them all to those bait fish. So,
yeah. Good, interesting. So it all depends on time of day and water temperature as to where they might be holding them.
Yeah. Walleye are pretty challenging fish to catch on a fly, I think. Just, I mean, it's doable, but they're different than any of the other predator fish. I mean, you have to be keen about the time of the day, and you have to have a pretty good idea of what they're eating in order to catch them. But they're a really neat animal. They're not a particularly good fighting fish, but of course, if you want to catch if you're going to keep any fish, that's probably the best eating fish there is. But
they are good. They are good.
Mm-hmm.
What are the biggest mistakes you see anglers make when fishing with bait fish patterns?
Probably the most common is just fishing them too fast, especially when you take somebody that, when you've taken somebody that's done a lot of trout fishing or even a lot of saltwater fishing and they're trying to kind of burn the fly through the water, and that's not really a winning tactic most of the time for bass, for any of these predator. You know, pike and muskie, they can go quite fast, but generally even the pike and muskie would much rather have a fly that's fished at a slow to moderate pace with some pauses, you know, and some good sharp strips in it than anything else. So, yeah, just too much speed, probably trying to cast too far a lot of times would be another one. Yep, those would be the two big ones.
Why too far? How does that
fix? Just a lot of times with the these warm water fish, you don't need to position yourself very far from structure, and a lot of times people will cast far but poorly, you know, or try to cast too far and end up with a poor cast rather than just moving themselves a little closer to the target and placing two or three accurate casts to one poor cast.
Okay, so that was my next question, is what are some effective techniques for fishing in heavy cover or structure? So you said shorten up your cast, be more accurate.
Shorten
what
up
else?
Your cast, but there's a couple things that I would say. I would shorten your leader to a heavy leader, and I would, you know, one of the tricks I use for a lot of different fish is that I use flies that have a bendable hook on them, and a lot of times you can kind of figure out what weight tippet will allow you to bend that hook if you get snagged. And then you can usually bend it back a few times, and warm water fish seldom bend the hook themselves. So you can typically resurrect a fly a couple times by using a weight of tippet that'll allow you to bend the hook out, and that way you preserve your fly. You can also, you know, you can use the, if you're using a floating line, you can use that floating line to maneuver your fly around the structure and keep your fly close to the structure for a little longer. That's another thing that can be very helpful when you're fishing around heavy timber.
Okay. How does water clarity and the light conditions affect the bait fish eye selection you make?
So water clarity, it wouldn't necessarily affect the selection of the bait fish as much as it would how I would, you know, I would probably scale back my tippet, especially if you're fishing in the way that I mentioned where you're adding those long pauses and bright sun, especially if there's some boat traffic around. It really helps to parse things down a little bit. Use maybe a little more sparse fly and a little bit lighter tippet. You know, I'm not somebody, if you're fishing in bright conditions, I would go with the bright fly, bright days. You know, if you look at the temperature of the light on a sunny day, if you're fishing in the summer, the days are really long, and when I'm snorkeling underwater, you can always see the yellow light reflecting off the side of the shiners and stuff. So a lot of times I'll use a pretty bright fly when the sun is out, and that's another trick. On a cloudy day, you might lean towards something that's a little more neutral, a little more silver. When I fish in the dead of the winter, the light coming off the snow is blue. You know, I'm not fishing for bass at that time, but the cold water fish really like blue in the winter.
And so when we're talking about maybe a dark or cloudy day, you go with a darker fly then?
Yeah, that's good. And especially if you're fishing a dark or cloudy day, or if you're fishing early in the morning or late in the afternoon, because a lot of times it won't be so much about the color, but just that they can see that profile against the surface of the water. So a lot of times I'll use, and the other thing is on a dark cloudy day or on early in the morning or in the afternoon, if I feel that the fish can't see it, I'll make sure that I tie a fly on that has some feel to it, like for example, a sculpin pattern that has a big head that can move some water, you know, If you're going to fish on the surface, obviously a popping bug would fall into that category. So those would all be things that I would do.
How does fish behavior change in rivers versus lakes when you're using baitfish patterns?
Sure.
Or does it?
That's a good question. It varies on the river system. There's a lot of instances I can think of, and the river that I'm on is composed of rivers and lakes because there's hydroelectric dams in it. But one thing I can think of, for example, that happens because it actually flows into a big lake that flows into Lake Michigan is that, we have migratory bait fish that come out of the lake into the river. And so you'll see fish that are actually eating, migratory bait fish like shad. And even occasionally alewives will come into our rivers. Another thing that you'll see if you fish in the middle of the summer that you don't have the luxury of in a lake is that you'll see that a lot of times even the big predator fish will move into the faster, more oxygenated water. It's where the bait fish need that oxygen. Some of the bait fish are more susceptible to the heat, so they'll move into the faster water, and then you'll have the big predator fish that like the oxygen too, but they really like to eat those fish that have moved in there. So you'll have, in a moving water system, you'll have that. You'll also have that in places that have springs, whether you're fishing in a river or a lake. If you have colder water that's coming in and it's a hot part of summer, you can bet that there's some kind of big predator fish in that area too.
Okay. Talking about a particular kind of flies, can you talk or have you used rattles or other sound-producing elements in your flies? And does that help?
Sure. Yeah. So I've tried all kinds of them, mainly because I like to catch some of these weird fish that don't necessarily take flies very well. Like, for example, if I want to catch a channel catfish or something, they need to be able to hear the fly or at least feel something. So I've tried rattles, and the ones I like to use the most are the kind that are built into a bead, so I can tie an articulated fly with two hooks, and I can put a bead between them that rattles, and you'll get that little rattle effect. The other thing to keep in mind is, like, one of the foods that I mentioned in the book that's not really a bait fish, but crayfish, they actually make a sound when they're going across the rocks, and that's why a lot of spin fishermen like to use rattles, because the crayfish actually make a slight clacking noise as they're going the rocks, and so rattles work really well in crayfish patterns too.
Okay.
Yep.
Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan says, within the Muskegon, is it worth fishing the big frog water sand bends, frog water sand bends with incredibly deep holes? If so, what
Sure.
typically stages down there, and what techniques would you use to fish for them?
That's a good question. I can tell you a lot, generally on the outside of the bends of those big deep holes, especially if they have rocks in to stabilize the banks and things like that, you'll find a lot of smallmouth there. That's a great way to fish, a goby pattern or a helgramite or a crayfish pattern. But the overlooked fish in those holes are the, we have quite a few northern pike that live on the inside of the bends, and most people don't even know they're there because most of the other game fish live in other parts of those runs, but there's usually some really big pike on the inside bends of those. A lot of people would just assume they not be there because those are often the same parts that have good trout fishing, and pike really like to eat trout. And then in the deepest part of the run, that's where almost every deep run in the Muskegon has walleye in the deep parts, and they are kind of an overlooked species in that river system. So there's a lot of stuff there. Certainly those holes hold a lot of fish. Some of them I look at, they're so big and relatively deep that you almost have to pick them apart like they're a lake, they're big.
Oh, those holes, yeah. Huh. Interesting. I'm trying to visualize that, but must be something kind of unique or specific to the Muskegon, that kind of setup there. Jim Wright in Thornton, Colorado asks, is there a searching baitfish pattern that you prefer to use when fishing new water? Now, that's kind of an open question when we're talking about smallmouth, largemouth, pike, muskie.
Right.
But maybe you could give us examples of several.
So, I mean, if I just had to choose one searching pattern, you know, I have a big articulated chub or goby pattern that's in the book I just wrote. I really like using that as a searching pattern because it's an attractive thing that if there's a big fish around, at least I can figure out what's in the run by casting something like that. But never go wrong by fishing a good shiner pattern, you know. Just about all our river systems have them. It doesn't hurt to have a black-nosed dace pattern if you're fishing smaller water. Black-nosed dace are really handy patterns. When I was a kid, that was one of the first patterns I learned to tie. But the only reason I say they're a great pattern is because even if your river doesn't have something like a black-nosed dace or your lake, there's things like blunt-nosed minnows and there's black-chin shiners that all look just like a black-nosed dace. And so you could use that pattern and be pretty confident that you would be able to match something in your waterway.
Okay. Chuck in Placerville, California was asking about line retrieval methods to animate the fly or entice a strike. I think we pretty well covered that. And he kind of specified that frequent pauses in the retrieval is what your big suggestion was for that. Dino in Florida wrote in and asked, he says, different patterns in retrieves in still waters versus light currents, especially with respect to largemouth bass. I guess he's looking for different patterns in retrieves.
Yeah, you know, for largemouth bass, I would think in your neck of the woods, I would definitely try to tie what's called a golden shiner. You know, golden shiners live in they're very common, especially in the southern states. Florida definitely has them. I grew up watching Jimmy Houston and Roland Martin catching big bass with them every weekend. So, but a golden shiner is a great thing to use. One thing I can tell you is if you're tying a big pattern and you're fishing around like heavy weeds where those golden shiners might live, you can always use what's called a keel hook, which puts the point of the hook upright, and it'll help to keep the fly weedless. So basically a nice kind of generic shiner pattern with either bucktail or maybe some craft fur that's yellow or cream or yellow mixed with that gray olive I told you, which I like a lot, and some gold flash would be a really good pattern for that. I don't think you could go wrong in those waters with you know, some kind of mobile light-colored fly.
Okay. Dino also had a question. He says, feeding response versus reaction hits. Do different patterns and retrieves favor any special tactics?
Well, generally, you know, the flashier the fly you use, the less realistic it is, but the more likely it's going to be to get that, you know, it's going to get that reactive response. There's definitely things like popping bugs will draw the reflex responsible. But, you know, I would just recommend experimenting with flies that are like your local bait fish, but that you've kind of souped up with additional flash colors just to see, because it seems like each waterway has kind of a combination of flash that works really well, and that would be a good way to get those big impulse strikes.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to drop down here to fly tying and innovation, talk about more about flies themselves. What are some key materials for tying realistic and effective baitfish imitations?
You know, some of them I've mentioned a couple times, but there's a lot of things that are really good. You know, some of the Antron-type dubbings, like Ice Dub, work really well for the shiner-type flies. If you're going to tie things like sculpins, or some of the bigger, wider bottom living bait fish like a goby, you might want to look to something that has, you know, if you're building that fly, you might want to use some of the more leggy type dubbings, you know, some of them that have some rubber built into them. I use a Fly Tires Dungeon product called Kraken Dubbing a lot that's got a lot of those fibers for those bigger flies. You know, if you're tying bait fish that are reflective, obviously kind of the flash that we talked about. You can also You know, one of the materials that really helps me is if I find a fly that I know is going to work, you know, I'll just tie it in different densities, and I'll tie it with some with bead chain, some with small light lead eyes, some that might have tungsten in them, and I'll just try to cover the spectrum in case the fish are feeding at different levels on a different day. But, you know, I've told you about some of the big gaudy flash colors that I really like, but if you're looking at Flashaboo, they make some really nice ones that work for some of the bottom living bait fish, like the sculpins, which might have kind of a olivey hue to them. I'll use the avocado colored flash, and I'll use some cranberry Flashaboo to add some color to the fins. So a lot of it just, you know, when you're imitating bait fish, what I tend to do is I tend to look at the qualities of the bait fish, and then I tend to just exaggerate one of the qualities if I want to, you know, draw an impulse strike from the fish. And a lot of times that'll help your fly stand out. The less realistic the fly, the less time you want them to give them on those pauses, because it will start to look unrealistic to the fish pretty quickly.
Yeah, the one thing you didn't, I don't think you've mentioned tonight, is calf's tail. Do you use much calf's tail?
You know, I used to.
Or
I don't
bucktail?
Use that a lot.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Bucktail?
I use a lot of bucktail. I use a fair amount of bucktail, yeah. I don't typically use it alone a lot. Sometimes I'll use clouser-type flies, because obviously that's a really good generic bait fish, and bucktail is really good with that. The other thing I'll use bucktail for is if I tie a fly that has a really long, flashy tail on it, and I'll put bucktail above and below the hook in front of that, and what that bucktail does is it keeps the more limp material from tangling on the hook, because bucktail is a pretty firm material. And so a lot of times I'll use those stiffer materials just to keep the more flexible materials in place. As far as furs go, probably the one I use the most is kind of an oddball called Australian Possum, and I use that a lot on my kind of bulky chub and sculpin and goby type patterns.
Okay. Stephen Sykes in Silver Spring, Maryland wrote in. He says, what are your thoughts on size and simplicity for tying patterns? Both streamer lengths and material lifts seem to get longer every year, and I'm wondering how you think about the trade-offs between time invested and realism, particularly when you're fishing only what you've tied.
Right. That's a great question. I have a lot of friends that tie beautiful, elaborate flies, and I admire them for that. You know, I have friends that tie musky flies that are just unbelievable. And I, you know, but for me, I'm a middle-aged guy with three kids, and I'm guiding a couple hundred days a year. So I, just by survival, I try to, if I find a pattern that works, I try to parse it down over time just to find out why, what the main ingredient to that fly is that's making it work, and then I try to build on that formula. So basically I try to keep, if I'm guiding, I try to keep my patterns under somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes to tie each night, just per fly, you know. So yeah, if you can simplify the fly, a lot of times the materials that'll help you do that, kind of get bang for your time, is, you know, things like flash like we talked about, or even things like adding a rattle that'll add some attraction to the fly that doesn't take a lot of time to add. And so just finding ways to simplify the fly while using really attractive materials, I guess that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I think that's, especially from a guide standpoint, because like when we were talking before the show, you said, yeah, well, while I'm waiting for the show to start, I'm going to tie a few flies for tomorrow because I got a guide in the morning.
Right.
I thought that was, but that's becomes, from a guide standpoint, that becomes super important, right? I mean, how
right.
much time you're going
Absolutely.
To spend behind the vise, right?
Yeah.
And
I mean, I still love tying, but I, in the same token, it's a job that has to get done every night.
Yeah.
So if I can have the same results with a more simple pattern, then absolutely I'm going to do it. But
yeah,
but
you're
it's
not
different
it's,
for.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's different for, you know, the great thing about fly fishing is it appeals to people in different ways. And if you tie a fly that takes an hour and it's what you want to do and you enjoy it, then that's just great too. Just for my situation, I'd say if you can get it done with less materials, then do it. So.
Yeah. Because for the kind of fish you're fishing for and the kind of flies you're tying, it's a bit different than whipping out a midge for a trout, right? It's like,
you
got a few hundred of those in an evening, but the ones you're tying, I imagine, take a lot longer.
Yeah.
Paul Schmidt in Gig Harbor, Washington, wrote in. He says, when tying baitfish patterns with hair like bucktail, my flies seem to fan out, which really decreases the slim baitfish look. Any tips on how to secure the material without this happening, or should this not be something to consider?
You know, you can certainly consider that, and I understand that consideration, especially if you're trying to get the fly to sink, because if it flares out too much, it's going to be really hard to sink that fly. But the main way to fix that is just to inspect the different bucktails you're looking at and just look for ones that don't have as many hollow fibers in them. You know, some of them have a lot of that base of the tail hollow fiber, whereas the fibers at the very end of the bucktail will typically be narrow and they won't flare as much. So, and different bucktails have varying amounts of that hair. Just kind of look at the bucktail, and you know, you can always go to alternate materials like synthetics, but bucktail is a great material. It's just sometimes it's hard to get it to do what you want it to do. So.
Yeah. Is there an alternative to bucktail that's synthetic?
Well, if you want something that does the same thing, I mean, there's some that call themselves substitute bucktail, but I mean, the easiest substitute is something like craft fur. The downside to craft fur is that it, you know, it is a softer material, so it will sometimes foul. So, so there's always a trade-off in materials.
Okay, good. Last question. So what advice do you have for anglers looking to improve their success with baitfish imitations? Last part
of baitfish imitations? Well, if you have the time to do it, first of all, the easiest thing to do when you go to the river is just to turn over a few rocks and just see what comes out from under the rocks, because a lot of the bottom-dwelling baitfish are going to be under the rocks, especially during the day, brightest part of the day. Once you go past that, you can go online, and what I tend to do is I go to a site called iNaturalist, because there's citizen scientists that report every minnow that they catch, and you can usually look at the body of the water that you're fishing, going to fish in, and you can see what people have been catching in the baitfish department from that particular body of water. If you want to take it further and really nerd out, you can buy a snorkel and mask and go underwater, and that's a great and really enjoyable activity, but it's definitely its own hobby in itself. So that's my advice.
I bet you learn a lot, though, from being underwater and, checking out the different areas of the fishery.
It's helped me enormously over the years. Just knowing the different, you know, I guide probably 60 to 80 miles of this river system in a year, and each different section of the river has its own unique about it. It really helps to have that extra little knowledge in your bag if you're going to do it, and it's fun. So.
Yeah, I bet. Well, Kevin, unfortunately I got to wrap things up here and call it quits for tonight, but hang with me here because we're going to give away a few prizes, including your book. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and your book, Matching Warm Water Baitfish, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So, and folks,
awesome.
If you want to learn more about Stackpole, go to stackpolebooks.com. We also have Kevin's two books on the front page, homepage of our website there, so you can order those books there if you don't win tonight. So. Hang tight here, and we'll be right back, and we'll give away those prizes. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings tonight are randomly selected from this show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out. You don't want to miss out on some of the great prizes we have to offer. If you're one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about Fly Fishers International, go to flyfishersinternational.org, and there you'll learn all about that great organization. Our winner for that is Rick Lesquire, I probably murdered that, but in Kentucky. So, Rick, you know who I'm talking about. Congratulations. I'm glad you won the membership to FFI, so enjoy your membership. And our winner for Trout Unlimited, and to find out more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. Our winner for that is David Pate in Texas. So, David Pate, congratulations to you, David. So now we need to find a winner for Kevin's most recent book, Matching Warm Water Bait Fish. And The way we play this game, is to you provide me with the correct answer. If you're the first person that does so, then you win Kevin's book. And what you have to do is fill out that form on our homepage, same place you could ask questions during the show. Put in your name and your location and your answer there, and you may be the proud winner of Kevin's latest book, Matching Warm Water Bayfish, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So, what was probably the favorite and most common color of craft fur that Kevin mentioned tonight? Favorite, most common color. Is that a fair question, Kevin?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Sometimes I come up with these questions and it's like, oh, well, that wasn't a very good question.
Yeah, but, I think I gave that one away a few times.
So. Yeah. So we got to wait a second. There's a slight delay for when people, for them to hear what we've said, hear the question, and then, of course, they have to type, get their hands off the fly tying vise and over to the computer. So So let's see what we get here. Okay. I've got, so far I've got a couple of answers coming in. Yellow and pink, that wasn't it. That's not what I was looking for, right?
Kevin? Right, yep.
Okay.
That's a great color combination, but that's not it. Yep.
Yeah. Another one I got in is olive, but I was looking for something more specific than that. Yellow olive? No. I think I got it here, Kevin. How about gray olive?
Oh, yeah, you got it.
That's it? Okay,
yep.
Dick. Dick, I don't have a last name for you here, but Northrook, and you're in Northrook, I believe. Dick, I'll need your full name and your address, and got your email address here, and your phone number. And send that to me in the same text box you just answered the question in. And then we'll get that book sent out to you from Stackpole. Now, Kevin, did you hear any more about them getting in more copies? Is there still a backlog, so to speak, on orders?
It should be in pretty soon. I haven't had an exact date, but
okay.
I have some author copies in, but I think their supply is rebuilding right now. So
okay.
Initially,
okay.
Yep.
So, Dick, just realize that it might be a few weeks before you get it. And you can always check in with me, and I'll check to see what's going on if you're getting anxious there. So, that's congratulations, Dick. Thanks for listening, and glad you were got the question right. Looks like Stephen Sykes, you were right behind him. And Richard's Cologne right behind as well. So there were a few people who had the right answer, but Dick was number one. So, well, great, great. Kevin, appreciate you so much for being on the show tonight with us. Pleasure to talk with you and learn more about warm water bait fishing. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, and tight lines to everybody out there.
Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look up in the link on our top line menu. In that archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 415 or something now, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase. So go ahead and explore, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you'll find out there. Our next broadcast will be on April 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I will interview Mikey Weir, and our show will be Klamath Reborn. Klamath River was once a legendary steelhead and salmon fishery, and now after the removal of four dams, it has been reborn. Mikey Weir works for California Trout, which works to improve the habitats of several fish species throughout California. He was also a professional guide and fished the Klamath River before and after the removal of the dam. So join us to learn how the river has changed, what it's doing, what the best places to fish it are and how to fish it. And Mikey will have some great information for us. Be sure to add this upcoming show to your calendar. Just click on the Add to Calendar button below Mikey's photo on the front page of our website, and we'll get you on your calendar there. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.